491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFDRadio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 315, recorded on Sunday, July 5th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill.
So this week we're going to be talking about the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 and the broader context of the Long Depression. This is continuing our sort of recurring on and off series about the Second Industrial Revolution period, the Gilded Age, and some of the economics and politics of that time period. We've talked a little bit about the Panic of 1873, which had a severe impact on the railroads, or the railroads had a severe impact on the panic, depending on your point of view. And we've also alluded to the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, but we haven't talked about them in a whole lot of detail because they were not central to what we were talking about when we were discussing sort of the early and to mid-1870s with Standard Oil and the railroads in the East. Rachel, talk to me about the Panic of 1873 and about the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 before we get into sort of the broader economic context.
So as we've kind of talked about before, the railroad had this huge boom cycle where there was a lot of investment in laying track down, in expanding rail lines, in just kind of creating these huge railroad companies. However, what goes up must come down. So a lot of this speculation just caused huge growth in the industry, but most of the capital invested was involved in projects offering no immediate or early returns, which caused a lot of economic strife. One of the big banking companies, Jay Cook and Company, was unable to sell millions of dollars in Northern Pacific Railway bonds. This is going to be a huge project, the second transcontinental railroad. So this firm had invested heavily in the railroads, but President Grant had a monetary policy of contracting the money supply, which raised interest rates, which created really unfavorable conditions for carrying debt. So these bonds weren't very attractive, and so the money just kind of dried up, and Jay Cook and Company failed. At this point, this kind of created a knock-on effect where other banking establishments kind of suffered the same problems. There was a chain reaction of bank failures, and this temporarily closed the New York stock market. This all was happening in 1873. And on September 18th, Jay Cook and Company declared bankruptcy. So this kind of caused problems with factory owners. So factories began to lay off workers. The United States kind of just slipped into an economic depression. So this really was concentrated in New York, but then kind of expanded to Chicago, San Francisco, and Nevada, where mining was active, but they're just the money dried up, so then mining didn't look as attractive at that point. So the New York Stock Exchange closed for 10 days starting September 20th, and then by November 1873, 55 railroads had failed, and then another 60 went bankrupt by the first anniversary of the crisis. So construction of new rail lines plummeted from 7,500 miles of track in 1872 to just 1,600 miles in 1875. 18,000 businesses failed between 1873 and 1875. Unemployment peaked in 1878 at 8.25%. Building construction was halted, wages were cut, real estate values failed, and corporate profits vanished. So this just created really, really bad conditions for both workers and company owners. In 1873, in the winter of 1873 to 1874, one in four laborers in New York were out of work. Wages overall dropped to 45% of their previous level by 1876. Unemployment peaked in 1876, reaching 14%, while many more were severely underemployed. There was just a lot of panic going on, and a lot of production just stopped, and so there just wasn't enough work. And this kind of led to an antagonism between workers and the leaders of industry. Immigration was increasing from Europe. Also, rural workers were migrating to the cities to look for work, which increased competition for jobs. And this really enabled companies to drive down wages and lay off workers if they complained. So this kind of reached a fever pitch by 1877, with rail lines instituting a further 10% wage cut. This really set off a lot of strife among railroad workers and led to workers conducting numerous railroad strikes. These strikes were then suppressed by violence, but this didn't really stop the labor movement from building momentum and performing more strikes over the years. It's interesting, many non-railroad workers joined in these strike actions just because they saw the power that the railroads had in the cities and how the railroads kind of dominated everyday life. Railroad traffic kind of crisscrossed through the cities and was often dangerous. So I think there was just a lot of vitriol that had kind of built up against the railroads, which kind of exploded and created these kind of cross-industry strikes that happened, where people working in mills and factories and mines joined in with the railroad workers during their strikes. This kind of culminated in the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, which is detailed in the history of the Pennsylvania Railroad Company, written by the railroad company. And the book, we've talked about this book before, it covers 1846 to 1946, and it's the railroad's official history of itself. So it starts June 1st, 1877. Railroad management of the Pennsylvania Railroad announced a 10% wage cut for all officers and employees. Also, they were double-heading trains on the Fort Wayne Road, which doubled the cars that could travel without adding additional trainmen. So further cutting the labor. Robert Ammon, a worker, was fired on June 1st, and he began to organize a trainmen's union on the Fort Wayne Road, which later extended to the Baltimore and Ohio lines and the Pennsylvania lines east of Pittsburgh. He called for a strike on the Fort Wayne Road for June 27th. And he was kind of hoping to kick off a more general walkout that would spread throughout the country. For some reason, the June 27th strike didn't happen, but on July 16th, there was a work stoppage in Martinsburg, West Virginia, on the Baltimore and Ohio line. The line was blocked for days. They had to call in national troops to clear out the strike because local militias were reluctant and unwilling to shoot on their fellow townspeople. So finally, federal troops had to come in. But by this time, the unrest had kind of spread throughout the country. Baltimore also had rioting during this time. Fast forward a few weeks, July 19th in Pittsburgh, two eastbound crews refused to work and two replacement crews also refused to work. So at this point, word of the work stoppage had spread and a mob of unemployed people formed, and they were joined by workers from factories and mills in Pittsburgh at the end of the workday. A sheriff's posse was called, but the crowd was able to chase them off. Again, the posse was kind of unwilling to shoot on their fellow townspeople. The next morning, two regiments of local militia were called in, but they were also largely sympathetic to the strikers. The governor called for a division of guardsmen from Philadelphia, and when word of that spread, the strikers were like further enraged. The strike spread to the Fort Wayne, the Panhandle, and the Allegheny Valley lines, and no trains left the city. July 22nd, the guardsmen from Philadelphia arrived around 5 p.m., and they actually fired on the strikers. This caused citizens from all over the city to arrive, from the mills, from the mines, and other manufacturing sites to fight the guardsmen and the railroad officials. By 8 p.m., citizens were breaking into armories for weapons to fight the guardsmen, and the guardsmen were pushed into one of the railroad's roundhouses for safety. The citizens fired on the roundhouse with the guardsmen returning fire. This kind of pushed the people back, but once they figured out the guardsmen weren't going to leave the roundhouse to fire on them, they decided to burn the troops out of the roundhouse. So due to the railroad blockade that had been going on for a few days, there were cars filled with coal, oil, coke, and other combustibles. The strikers quickly set car after car on fire, and they refused to allow local firefighters in to attempt to put the fires out. They said their goal was to burn the railroad's property without harm to any persons or any citizens' personal property. And this was borne out when someone's lumber caught fire. They doused the flames and moved the lumber to safety. At this point, the roundhouse wasn't really threatened with the fire yet, so the people commandeered a coke car. They poured oil all over it, lit it on fire, and then pushed it against the roundhouse. Then the roundhouse did catch fire, and the military was forced to fight their way out while the strikers just kept pushing burning cars against railroad buildings to accelerate and maximize the damage. By the next morning, the flames had, quote, enveloped hundreds of cars, machine shops, two roundhouses, the depots and offices of the Union Transfer Company, blacksmith shops, storehouses, and numerous other buildings making up the terminal facilities of the Pennsylvania Railroad. In the roundhouses were 125 first-class locomotives, which had been housed as a consequence of the strike. And the strike continued to spread to Albany in the east and Missouri and Kansas in the west. On July 25th, the workers agreed to a conference with management. By July 28th, traffic had resumed. It doesn't really state it outright in the book. They weren't able to find kind of a conclusive bargaining that had occurred, and it is inferred that the wage reduction did remain in force. As the strikes kind of spread throughout the country, it sounds like they didn't really win that much. A lot of the demands weren't met. It began to lose momentum when President Hayes sent federal troops from city to city, and these troops suppressed strike after strike. The strike lasted approximately 45 days, and it was pretty much over at that point. They didn't really win a lot of their demands. A lot of the wage cuts were held in place and still enforced, but labor did kind of make their point, and they did enact a lot of damage. It says in the book, the claims filed against the county of Allegheny for property damage as a result of the Pittsburgh strike, the damage incurred during the riots totaled $4,100,000, and that of the Pennsylvania Railroad Company alone, $2,312,000. Eventually, they were compromised for $2,772,000, of which the railroad company received $1,600,000. So labor kind of made their point in property damage. After the Great Strike of 1877, labor just kind of continued to build and build power and build momentum, and many more strikes followed after this. And management kind of had to kind of adapt, and a lot of them lobbied for conspiracy laws, so you couldn't conspire or organize. It became illegal at that point, but this didn't really stop the momentum of the workers, and they continued to unionize and continued to build power through striking.
All right, so Kelly, you looked up some information about the broader labor context at this point, because as Rachel has just said, there were some points made perhaps, but not necessarily the most successful outcome for this pretty widespread strike. And in many ways, as Rachel just said, this lays the foundation for a lot of the labor movement that followed it, you know, after these events of 1877. But I guess there's some questions that we had as we were preparing this about whether this was kind of an outlier in many ways, although obviously I guess if it's foundational to what came after, that would make sense that it was a bit of an outlier. And there were certainly some effects, but how do we look at this in the broader context of the period in terms of the labor movement, what was accomplished, what was not accomplished, and that sort of thing?
Yeah, those are great questions. I think that it's important to note that there had been strikes going back 100 years in the United States, but the railroad strike of 1877 is really considered the first nationwide strike and the first event of its scale, really. I think it's clear to see that it did kick off a new phase in labor organizing in the United States. I do not think that change was immediate. I mean, I think it took another decade for labor organizers to really organize themselves and get the trust and the buy-in of the workers. But I think it is clear that this really planted a seed. This event planted the seed in the mind of a lot of influential labor organizers. And I think one thing that's important to know is that while it was happening, people weren't sure if it was a strike or it was the beginning of another revolution. This was an event of such a significant scale in so many cities. And so one indication that although they were not successful in getting the wage increase that they or the stay in wages that they requested is that Robert Harris, the president of the Burlington Railroad, wrote, "We have seen that a reduction of pay to the employees may be as expensive as an increase in pay," which just goes to show that people at the very top sort of did the math and realized how powerful this strike could be. And while, again, they weren't successful in adjusting their wages, the railroad did start setting up a system for death benefits for those who were killed on the job and other sort of benefits in an effort to try to prevent this from happening again in the future. Like I said, this was really the beginning of a period of strikes that took a little while to get established. So in 1881, there were just 4 years after the railroad strike, there were 100,000 workers who engaged in 471 strikes over the course of the year. But by 1886, over 400,000 workers participated in nearly 1,500 strikes over the course of the year, which I think just illustrates the dramatic change in the tactics that labor was taking to get what they earned and needed in order to live. One interesting note is that there were a lot of different opinions on how to proceed after this event. The Knights of Labor, which were the largest organization at the time, sort of thought of themselves as trying to be a big umbrella group that brought in as many different parties and types of people as possible. But they weren't always on the side of strikes at the national level. A lot of the strikes which happened were organized by local chapters of the Knights of Labor. They weren't clearly bought in at the national level. Eventually, the Knights of Labor were sort of brought down by their own disorganized leadership, as well as bad publicity following a bomb thrown at the Haymarket riot in 1886. And sort of waiting in the wings was the Federation Trades of North America in 1881, which later became the American Federation of Labor in 1886. Samuel Gompers, who founded that group, he said of the railroad strike of 1877, that without organization strong enough to conduct a successful strike, the railway workers rebelled. And so his argument was that the strike of 1877 was really a rebellion because there was no organization in place to organize a strike. And so he really saw the strike's failure as a result of that lack of organization. And it is with that belief that he built what would become the AFL. So again, an incredibly significant group in American labor history that had roots here in the 1877 strike and was really born out of what Samuel Gompers saw as a need for organization amongst laborers in order to really be able to demand these changes rather than this rebellion, which was significant and certainly did quite a bit to scare the leaders of the railroads and sort of kick off a movement of national labor unrest. But at the end, they weren't able to get what they had originally demanded. And I think as we reflect on this event, there's two important questions. And the first question is, why was the strike of 1877 so widespread? What was it about this event that led to so much participation? 100,000 people participated in the strike. And I think that Rachel touched on a lot of the sort of tinderbox aspect of this strike over the years. And especially within that last year before the strike, railroad workers had been aggrieved multiple times by previous pay cuts, being asked to operate two freight cars with the only enough workers for one. The work was dangerous. People were beginning to move into cities to take these industrial jobs, and that in itself presented significant dangers, as the city was at the time a largely unsanitary and uncomfortable place to live. And so I think that another aspect of this, of why was it a railroad strike and not a shoe factory strike, is that the railroad was a physical connector of workers who were geographically separate. Workers in a shoe factory in New Hampshire might have not felt so connected to workers on a shoe factory in North Carolina. But with the railroad, it was like a practical mechanism for spreading the message of the strike, as well as a very legitimate interconnectedness that was born out of this type of work that united workers across the country, really. Like I said, one of the interesting things and one of the reasons why it feels difficult to draw really specific conclusions about the effect of this strike is that it did take another decade or so until the labor militancy really rose in the 1890s. The seeds were clearly planted here in 1877, but it took a little while to get organized. It took a little while for those organizations to become established. And then in the 1890s, we really begin to see some more of the famous strikes. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. One reason is just a demographic shift. Between 1880 and 1900, the population of cities rose by 15 million, while 40% of townships lost population to urban migration. So people began leaving agricultural communities. They were working these hierarchical industrial jobs. The living conditions, like I mentioned, were quite difficult. People were close together, which is key for organizing ahead of the time of cell phones. They were sort of working shoulder to shoulder all day and then going back to this housing where they essentially lived shoulder to shoulder all evening. So there was plenty of rich opportunity for folks to get organized and begin to find ways to act upon their grievances. And as a result of this migration and just popular opinion on unions in the time, the participation in labor unions really began to rise. A lot of that can be credited to the AFL, which really created a structure for individual trades and individual organizations to advocate for what was pertinent to them, but also sort of house themselves and live in this large national and even international structure. So all of these conditions in the 1890s led to a lot more strikes, a lot more violent strikes. But we can really look back and see that the seeds were planted in this 1877 strike, which clearly demonstrated the power of strikes, the power of the laborers, and also influenced some of the prominent labor leaders that would go on to lead those strikes and those activities in the 1890s.
We are going to talk in just a few minutes about the economic conditions of the 1870s and the 1890s and so forth, and the context around those distinctions. But there's a few other things that I think we should tease out here. So one of the sort of, I think, modern parallels that is worth drawing, I mean, this applies to many different time periods, is this idea of organization versus spontaneous acts of rebellion in the way that Samuel Gompers had sort of characterized it. The 19th century in general, especially in Europe, but also as we're seeing in incidents like this in the United States, was often characterized by these sort of spontaneous acts of rebellion that didn't really end up going anywhere. They caused a lot of damage. Maybe people lost their lives, but they didn't go anywhere. Oftentimes, I think leftist organizations have been criticized for not necessarily embracing revolutionary moments or being a little slow on the uptake to certain world historical crises and that sort of thing. Joke about the Russian Revolution, several decades later in 1917, was that the people had to basically go into the streets and demand that the Bolsheviks seize power in a coup because they kept on saying the time isn't ready yet, the time isn't ready yet. But in defense of the sort of organizers side of things on the left and among the workers, it is also clear that just purely having a spontaneous uprising is generally not enough for success. Obviously, most typically this would be seen in places like France. You know, there would be many uprisings, especially the one sort of famously depicted in Les Mis, where, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of organization. People spontaneously rose up. They made a series of tactical mistakes or failed to seize on the seize on the moment of uncertainty from the, you know, ruling powers that be, to consolidate their rebellion. 1848, of course, all across Europe, you had these moments where people sort of spontaneously rose up. Any organized left, such as there was not prepared for it and not really part of that decision to rise up. And, you know, you'd have rulers initially maybe make a few concessions that they would then walk back and revoke as soon as it was possible or as soon as the troops had arrived. So that is one sort of key takeaway here, is that not having organization means that you're not likely to get a whole lot out of these sort of uprisings. And that's a tough balance because, of course, as we know, I mean, something that emerged following the 1877 strike would be extensive efforts to infiltrate left organizing and labor organizing, which is obviously something that continues to today. And another just, you know, obvious parallel that was in mind in the minds of a lot of Americans, especially owners, not just workers, in the 1870s and also through the 1890s and so forth, was the recent failed uprising of the Paris Commune of 1871 after the Franco-Prussian War, and this was sort of the specter of communism or whatever you want to call it that was haunting American business owners throughout this time period. Why 1877, though? That remains an important question as well. So Kelly mentioned that President Hayes sent in federal troops. Well, President Hayes was a new president at this point in time in 1877. He took office in March of 1877 following a very protracted crisis that you might have learned about in your U.S. history course. The Compromise of 1877 was to try to resolve the very heavily disputed results of the 1876 presidential election. As we're about to talk about, the Grant administration had ended basically in economic disaster. Well, it had been dragging on for quite a while at that point, and people were ready for a change, but they weren't necessarily ready to elect the Democrats, and Reconstruction was still in progress. Hayes comes in and agrees to end Reconstruction. There's debate among historians about whether or not that would have happened anyway, or whether that was an explicit deal to secure his election with the disputed results. A lot of the disputed results had to do with the status of states under Reconstruction governments and so forth. But anyway, Reconstruction comes to an official end. Federal troops are withdrawn from the South, and all of a sudden you have federal troops that can be deployed against organized labor in the country's north. So this is a obvious context to this time period that maybe makes 1877 unique. But as we're going to talk about, this is sort of still, in many ways, a kind of puzzling outlier. We're about to talk, as I said, in a few minutes about the overall economic conditions. But as Kelly alluded to, it really did take a while before strikes became a much more widespread feature of American life. And at the time, the 1870s were broadly characterized for not having much in the way of labor strikes. You know, and as Kelly had said, there used to be strikes for, you know, many years, in fact, like a century preceding this, but this was the first sort of nationwide one. And again, the question becomes, why 1877? What made that different? But also, the inverted question you could always ask is, well, why weren't there other strikes happening the rest of the time? So let's talk about that broader economic context. So we're going to be talking about the Long Depression, and we'll talk about what I mean by that time period specifically, because it's sometimes used in different ways. I think there's going to be a lot of parallels again to our current era, that are things that people, that might be hard to see right now while it's happening, not for everyone, but I think, you know, as we'll talk about, the economic conditions of the time period that we're going to be looking at are sort of strange within American history, which is not surprising in light of what we've been talking about in recent episodes about how this second industrial revolution period was such a new permanent sea change in American capitalism as a whole. And, you know, the manufacturing industry and the transportation industry, all of these things were undergoing these enormous changes. You know, Kelly and Rachel have both been alluding to a number of these changes, and Kelly in particular talking about the demographic shifts that happened during and after this period, which is one reason it's possible to sort of delineate the period fairly clearly. So the crash of 1873 sort of kicks off the Long Depression. There had been this boom period after the American Civil War ended in 1865. This pretty definitively comes to an end in the crash of 1873. There's a brief recovery in 1879. There's a recession of 1882 to 1885. And then there's a crash in 1893. And you could very narrowly be talking, as some people do, about just the period of 1873 until that recovery in 1879 as the Long Depression. But for our purposes, we're going to be talking about the period that starts with the crash of 1873 and then is bookended by the crash of 1893. And you might ask, well, why you know, consider the end of one economic depression to be the beginning of another? And I think that will become evident in just a moment as to why that makes sense as a period of delineation. So the one reason that I'm grouping this all together is that railroads again and again play a role in this. In panics that we see, in market panics that we see in 1873, 1883, 1893, we're talking over and over again, not just in the U.S., but also in many other countries, about a number of factors coming together, but usually the common link between all of them was collapses of railroad companies and financial investment firms that invested in railroad companies. But the Long Depression, as is obvious from what I've just said about this sort of cycle where there were some recovery periods and then followed almost immediately by more economic problems, is a little bit different. It's not a continuous depression in the way that we might define it now, but again, it's not necessarily productive to define it in that way because, you know, if you look at the time period that we're in now, you could say, well, you had a recession at this point in the 90s, and then you had a recovery, and then you had the dot-com bust, and then a little bit of a recovery, and maybe there's a post 9/11 thing, or was that the same as the previous crash? And then there was a recovery, but it wasn't very strong, and then you had the crash of 09, etc. So you can see how just grouping things based on whether or not the economy was quote-unquote growing on paper is not, or contracting, is not necessarily a great way of grouping together an overall time period in which you might see some common through lines. And I think you're going to see a lot of the common through lines from this Long Depression period from 1873 to 1893 are similar to things that we're experiencing now in many fundamental ways. So keep that in the back of your head as we're going through this. So over this period, there did continue to be GDP growth and industrial growth, but there were significant market crashes, as I just said, about every 10 years, and then there would be market instability on either side of those crashes for quite a long time period. But there were also actual contraction periods, and some of them quite long. Now, later on, we understand fundamentally that the Great Depression, we say, oh, that basically went from 1929 until World War II, and that can be grouped as one period. But when they were actually in the Great Depression, they kept on trying to hype everyone up to, oh, it looks like the market's really turning around now, and we're finally getting growth again, and so forth. And so it can be a little bit tricky to, within the time period, to cherry pick. Like, if you just cherry pick certain data on paper, you can make things look better than they actually were, as opposed to a longer period of coherent stagnation at best, and decline at worst. The longest economic contraction outright in all of U.S. history occurred in that period from October of 1873 to March of 1879, and that includes the incidents of 1877 that we've been discussing so far today. But as should be obvious by now, the question again is, why was there an uprising in 1877 only, as opposed to why wasn't there uprisings in the rest of this time period? And I don't know if we have a great answer to that question other than the speculation we've already made. The third longest contraction in American history was that second recessionary period of the Long Depression, 1882 to 1885. Obviously, number two in terms of length was the Great Depression. Output from factories tended to remain at least flat during these waves of economic crises rather than falling. And so again, that makes it look on paper like the economy is doing better than it probably actually was, because if we measure how the economy is doing based on increases or decreases in output, especially output combined altogether as gross domestic product, you could make an argument that things were doing okay. But that does sort of obscure what was actually happening. Also, what we're seeing consistently throughout a lot of this period, even if there were counter trends at certain points, was that stock prices were falling, goods prices were falling, profits were falling, wages were falling, and job numbers were falling. Again, you could look at cherry pick specific points of data where you would show the opposite trends happening, but the overall thing that makes this a coherent period of the 1870s and 1880s, before that 1893 crisis, is that output is remaining flat or growing, but all of these other things are falling. As I said, there's some debate among economists today as to whether or not there was GDP growth happening during this period under how we would define it in modern terms. But of course, it's maybe a mistake to define it in modern terms, because the Second Industrial Revolution is a period of economic development in the United States that had never happened before. So this was a unique phenomenon at the time. Obviously, many of the things that happen in the economy of the United States later are things that are all precedents set by this period or the after effects of this period. But this is the first sort of very significant large-scale industrialization there had been the first industrial period, but as we've been talking about, in terms of modern capitalism with these giant industrial corporations, many of them spanning huge regions, if not the entire country, and with all the effects, both positive and negative, of those trends happening. I also think there's a valid comparison to be made to something like recent economic history of China, which is, you know, something that has been undergoing a similar period like the Second Industrial Revolution, where you have this very significant period of economic development as a developing nation, which the United States would have been essentially an industrializing developing nation at the time. And you compare that to China, you had this period, which is sort of coming to a close, where the authorities in China were constantly afraid that double-digit growth was going to go to single-digit growth, and that would still be well above, say, you know, U.S. or European growth rates, but, everyone's expecting this huge growth rate, and we need this huge growth rate to sustain our growing labor force and that kind of thing. And I think there's a comparison to be made there. It's also possible, I think, to confuse the concept of economic growth based on paper things like, output and production increases, and say that that's real economic growth, which is certainly economic growth for the ownership class, as opposed to meaningful economic growth felt by everyone else. And that is, of course, why it's called a Gilded Age and not a Golden Age, right? The idea that all of this glitz and riches was very superficial. It was just sort of painted onto the outside of things. And overall, the economic situation was pretty bad for ordinary people, not the rich. So why do we differentiate this from the 1890s? So the severe economic catastrophe of 1893 to 1897 is generally viewed as being different from and following after the Long Depression period, because there was at that point no obscuring the economic doldrums by getting people to go shopping, as we'll talk about, or contending that production was still growing. The 1890s saw, as Kelly said, an explosion of labor militancy and trade unionism and socialism that was not present in the 1870s and 1880s when people were able to buy goods and foods. But instead, all of a sudden, we now see starving masses. There was actual mass starvation happening, or at least very widespread hunger crises happening in much of the 1890s in this period after 1893. And that was not a feature of the Long Depression of the 1870s and 1880s. That right off the bat is obviously a huge distinction. There was also the populist movement in mainstream American politics, William Jennings Bryan's takeover of the Democratic Party, and McKinley's Republican realignment. So there definitely was something different about the economic crisis of the 1890s compared to the economic crises of the 1870s and 1880s. The 1890s was notably distinct from and put an end to the earlier period as well because of something that Kelly alluded to when she was talking about migration from rural areas to cities. There was a wide-scale exit of personnel and population from agricultural production. Farmers had been struggling for the two previous decades, and they had been kind of making it work, which is another difference between the 1870s, 1880s period and the 1890s period. And at that point, they basically start bailing out in large numbers. They say, this is not working out for me. Why did they leave? Well, there's sort of three key factors. Capital debts were mounting. There were mounting prices for shipping and storage of grain in the rail industry, something that we've talked about before on the show that they were constantly complaining about, but that finally they get to a breaking point in the 1890s as opposed to just toughing it out in the Long Depression period. Finally, falling grain prices due to vast overproduction. And this concept of overproduction is one we're going to keep returning to for the remainder of this episode. Tied up in both the issue of overproduction and the issue of capital debts is the arrival of significant industrial mechanization in the 1870s, especially after wartime labor shortages during the Civil War had spurred innovation in terms of mechanical processes for farming. There had been earlier developments in terms of mechanization of farm equipment that had helped increase productivity and so forth in the first Industrial Revolution or even the Renaissance period in Europe. But in terms of some of the stuff that basically, apart from, you know, the later advent of tractors and things like that, which didn't arrive in this period, we are talking about a pretty significant increase in mechanization of farm production. According to Census Bureau data that I found in a 1927 Congressional Research Service report, or I think it was CRS, from published at CQ Press website now, the total value of all farm machinery nationwide rose by nearly $250 million from 1860 to 1890. By 1889, American manufacturers were producing $81 million worth of farm machinery annually, compared to just $17 million per year in 1859, right before the American Civil War. So, again, two things that affects. One, you can now produce significantly more crop yields. That's going to vastly flood the market with far too much food production in terms of maintaining prices. Obviously, there's an inherent conflict there in terms of we want to have lots of food production to feed all these people and not have famines. But we also, if there's no intervention by the government essentially to stabilize or some sort of cartel function like we saw in the oil industry to stabilize prices, if you have an oversupply, the prices are going to crater. And that is something that you have to have very large industrial syndicates to be able to absorb that hit, like Standard Oil did in the oil industry. At this point, we don't have the large agribusinesses. We mostly have these smallholder farmers. And if the prices, if they're not able to work in concert and the prices all collapse, a lot of them are going to go bankrupt and they're going to quit the industry eventually. Similarly, if they have to borrow a lot of money to buy capital equipment for their farms in the form of this industrial mechanical equipment, they're going to be taking on these debt loads that then they can't get out from under if there's a bad harvest, which periodically obviously happens. But this theme is something that comes up again and again in terms of the Long Depression, which obviously then reaches that breaking point in the 1890s, triggering that crisis, is that over this period, we're seeing productivity per worker increase and so forth, and we're seeing the output increasing. So on paper, you could say, oh, look, the economy's doing great, except that there are obvious economic consequences for the producers if the prices are continuing to fall, and those need to be examined in terms of what their implications are, because there's obviously some positives from prices falling, but there's some negatives, as we just examined from the perspective of farmers. So why were prices and wages falling during this period? Well, for one thing, there may have been less money in circulation with which to pay people and buy goods and services, and that was due to U.S. government monetary policies that often pulled currency out of circulation explicitly, or at the very least, minted fewer coins. These policies were intended to strengthen the dollar, which would make each dollar buy more things, so of course the price would go down on goods and services, but effectively that does mean lower prices. It also means lower wages, which then leads to unhappiness and incidents like we talked about with the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. Now, this explanation around the monetary policy was the explanation favored at the time and became a dominant factor in political debates. Things like the Cross of Gold speech and things like that are all related to this monetary policy debate. And some economic historians still favor this explanation, but there are other economic historians who dispute the figures themselves and argue that actually the money supply was growing over this time period for the most part, even if it was growing slowly. Now, you could counter that by saying, again, it's all about rate of growth. If the rate of growth is too slow relative to the overall growth of the economy or various growth of industry and things like that and the growth of consumer base, then it's not going to keep pace. And so even if it's technically growing, it will feel like a contraction. Regardless of that, the other thing is that because the U.S. was suddenly producing so many manufactured goods, there was a lot of money pouring in from overseas as people were buying those in terms of export goods. Later on, we're obviously going to get into the period of tariff wars and so forth. And there were periods, there were times during this period where there were repeated waves of protectionist tariff wars that were often mitigating the potential impact in terms of adding money supply through this foreign trade. But perhaps more importantly is the same phenomenon that we see in the agricultural sector, but from the industrial side. Massive industrial processes made it possible to mass produce and deliver across transportation networks both finished consumer goods and component goods like steel much more cheaply than ever before and in much more greater volumes than ever before. Now, this doesn't include, and this is also critical to understanding why this is an economic crisis and not an economic boom, is that artisanal goods did not see prices decline, nor did services. So the pitch that is often made is like, well, everyone's standard of living was effectively rising, even if their wages were remaining flat or going down because prices were falling. But again, prices were only falling for things that were being significantly industrialized such that production could go up so rapidly that the prices would fall because of oversupply in the market. This is something that we talked about with the overproduction of oil production capacity and rail capacity, where there was an overbuilding problem that would then cause prices to fall, which would cause companies to collapse and go bankrupt, which would cause financial investment firms to go bankrupt. And you can begin to see here why, even if there was some benefits from the consumer side to these falling prices and falling profits, that you were actually repeatedly having economic crises, which is why we can view this as a long depression. Companies that were struggling with lower prices and dramatically falling profits tried to take advantage of high rates of immigration, high rates of population growth as the food supply became increasingly stable, and high rates of unemployment related to these market crashes to cut their wages, to offset their lower prices, to offset their dramatically falling profits. Now, just very briefly tangent, we're not going to get into it a whole lot here, but Karl Marx, obviously a core thing that he had identified was the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, which, to put it in extremely simplified terms, it basically makes sense here that as you improve your production methods with a capital investment up front, you will initially be able to, you know, make so many goods that you can meet and previously unmet demand or something like that, or you've saved a lot of money per unit in your production, and so you're going to make a huge amount of profit right initially, and then suddenly the market is going to fall out from under you because everyone else is going to make the same capital improvements. Everyone else is going to open a factory that does the same thing at the same price, if not cheaper, and then they're going to cut the prices of their consumer goods that they're producing or their unfinished, you know, steel or whatever. They're going to try to outcompete you, and therefore the profits are going to go down. That's a very, very basic, super preliminary way of explaining the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. You can see that happening in real time here. And this was a phenomenon that he identified from the earlier stages of industrialization that then becomes crystal clear in this time period during the second industrial revolution, that he was essentially correct about that. Although then, as we'll, you know, you could talk about why that didn't, why that itself became a boom-bust cycle, where they figured out how to go find more explosions in profits before having yet another crash. During this time period, globally, a new wave of imperialism kicked off that tried to alleviate the issue of declining domestic profits as well, while also giving people a nationalist focus to avoid thinking about organizing around the economic stagnation. And that new wave of imperialism in the 1880s and 1890s and so forth was the subject of Lenin's elaborations upon the works of Karl Marx, because Marx died during this period that we're talking about. So you can obviously find out more about how the capitalist class figured out ways of avoiding this profit problem. But companies were struggling, as I said, with these falling prices and falling profits. They found ways to try to offset that, but this obviously had consequences for people as well. Wages fell in nominal terms, so that's like the dollar amount as opposed to the purchasing power amount, by a quarter nationwide in the 1870s. In localized areas, wages fell by much more. And at best, in real terms, in terms of how much purchasing power there was, they stagnated during this period. So they didn't really grow a whole lot. And they were likely aided in, the companies were often aided in the push to cut wages, not just by this pressure of, hey, we could hire anybody, there's so many workers here and there's so many immigrants, but also because of, again, this declining cost of living as consumer goods prices fell, which I think is the clearest parallel to today, where we can almost continually see certain consumer goods prices falling. Although, again, as in the 1870s, 1880s period, there were other goods and services that did not see the costs go down. So it's not true to say that this was falling across the board. And that obviously means that if your wages are stagnating or going down, that you are not able to buy as much stuff. But in terms of many key consumer goods, especially things like food, but also just sort of things that had previously been luxuries but were now available for mass production pretty cheaply to people, that was a persistent phenomenon that maybe helped people avoid going on strike during this period. And of course, once you have actual, you know, economic catastrophe set in the 1890s in terms of like famines, then you can see why labor militancy would burst back out into the open. Another clear comparative point, this era saw the rise of chain department stores in popularity, and that might be paralleled today by big box store chains with similar economic effects on both consumer goods access. It's easier and cheaper to get consumer goods, as well as area wages and also, you know, pushing out small business owners and things like that. And finally, rising productivity per worker due to new industrial innovations meant that companies could potentially lay off workers to offset their profit declines during investment market contractions, rather than hiring more workers to produce more goods using these new, more productive innovations. So again, if you want to make a whole bunch of profit, if you're this an industrial tycoon entering a new frontier of mass production in some arena, one way is that you could just say, okay, I can now make tons and tons more goods per worker, so I'm going to hire lots of workers and make my money in volume. But every time there was an economic collapse and a market crash, which also obviously created, you know, capital financing problems for making expansions or opening new factories, the tendency instead was to actually just lay off workers and say, well, we're getting more per worker, so we need fewer workers. So again, you see that fundamental tension here, where on the one hand, productivity is growing, but on the other hand, you're having persistent unemployment problems fluctuating up and down, and you're having wages either stagnating at best or actually declining. So that is my wrap up on the Long Depression, and I think some important context for that uprising in 1877. Rachel, I'll go to you first for your closing thoughts.
Well, I think something to keep in mind as we compare that time period with our current time period is that things don't happen overnight. So even though there was an uprising in 1877, it didn't really translate to results until up to two decades later. So I think people are kind of demanding overnight success and then kind of berating the labor movement when that doesn't materialize. So I think that's something to keep in mind. These things take time, and it's not going to be an overnight success. So I think we do need to organize. We need to build the labor movement, but we really need to be in it for the long haul to see real substantial results.
Kelly, I guess I'll go to you for your closing thoughts.
The point I would make is a compliment to Rachel's point, which is not only is this a long process, but what I'm really fascinated by is the spark. And it seemed like the conditions in the 1890s were a lot more conducive to that spark sort of setting fire because people were so desperate. But I think it is interesting and important to think about what is that spark in 1877? What are those sparks in the 1890s? And then what are the sparks we see today? And what are the conditions for really translating those sparks into action, as Rachel mentioned?
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
And Rachel, thank you for being on the show as well.
Thanks, Bill.